Happy Trinity Sunday, Happy Father's Day, and Happy Pride Month. One of the biblical scholars I read to prepare for this sermon warned against what he calls the temptation to heady exhortation on this day. It's true that this little nugget of Jesus' teaching could lead to some theological muscle flexing. In 12 minutes, the preacher gets to tell you what the Trinity is and what truth is, and I'm not going to do that. Because Jesus knew what his disciples needed then and what we need now is not an intellectual exercise around what the Trinity is and isn't. He knew that what his group of followers needed was a deep assurance of his presence. So that is where I want to start. And along the way, I'd like to encounter the Trinity in a perhaps fresh way that might change the way that we live our lives. First, I want you to start by opening your imaginations. Close your eyes, if that helps. Listen to your breath. Notice the sounds around you. Take time to feel where your body is tightly wound and invite grace into those spaces. Breathe in God's love for you and breathe out. Keep your eyes closed if they are. As we open a window into the gospel story for today, it is late at night in an upper room. Through the window comes the sounds of others who are still awake, and there is a slight coolness in the air. The remains of supper are still on plates, but they have been pushed aside for now. It's been a long night already. Jesus has washed your feet, and then his face fell as he told you that one of your friends would betray him. Judas fled into the night, and Jesus let him go. In the air hangs a foreboding of what is coming. You can read it on your friends' faces. Worry, anxiety, sadness. It seems like maybe you should leave this place and find somewhere safe to hide, but Jesus keeps on talking. His face, as he looks at each of you, is full of love. I am with you only a little longer. I chose you. Love one another. I will ask the Father, and he will give you another advocate to be with you forever. I will not leave you orphaned. Abide in me. You see deep sadness on his face as he also says, the world will hate you. You will be persecuted. I am leaving. At one point, Jesus beckons, rise, let us be on our way. And you wonder where you are going as you follow him out into the dark street. He does not tell you, but he keeps speaking with such an urgency that you know there is not much time left. He keeps saying, I will not leave you alone. You want to cry out. You've said you're leaving. You look at your friends as you hurry to keep up with his pace. What can he mean? How does this make sense? Your feet grow heavier and heavier with a sense of impending loss, and fear begins to take hold of your heart. Then Jesus stops in the middle of the road. You can see he has so much more to say, but instead he lets the silence hang in the night. Then he says with such gentleness that you feel you might break into, I still have so many things to say to you, but you cannot bear them now. Then he says, all he has is yours, because his Father has said it is so. everything he has, all of it, he will give to you. What can it mean? Come back into this room as you're ready. Let me ask you a question. If the disciples had known what was coming that night and in the days ahead, would they have slipped off? Jesus had let Judas slip off. Maybe they could just run into the night, go back to their lives. But they did stay with Jesus. And later they would understand bit by bit what they could not absorb or bear then. Their minds and hearts were already flooded, and Jesus knew that. Haven't we all been there at a cusp of a journey so long and hard that if we had known what it would be at the time, we would have opted out? Like Frodo in Lord of the Rings, as he leaves his safe, warm home to venture out with the ring. His old life lay behind in mists. Dark adventure lay out in front. Later, as his footsteps grow heavier and the ring grows almost too much to bear, he says, "I wish the ring had never come to me. I wish none of this had happened." And Gandalf replies, "So do we all who live to see such times, but that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given to us." And so we put one foot in front of the other, and we wander down paths for which we have no map. I have been on such journeys before, and I know you have too. Maybe you're on one right now. If you are, take heart. Jesus has been right where you are, on a journey so hard it seemed impossible. And even as he walked his own path of sorrow, he ministered to his disciples with his presence and this beautiful, mysterious interplay of words. Let them crest over you like music and feel the impact on your heart without trying to parse them apart. The Spirit will take what is mine and declare it to you. All the Father has is mine, and I will declare it to you. I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine grower, and you are the branches. I am in my Father, and you in me, and I in you. There is a mutuality, an interplay, a separateness, and yet oneness between Jesus and God and the Spirit, and we are drawn into it. Jesus shows us to trust him is not about understanding with our heads, but with our hearts. The mystery of the Trinity is an invitation to come more deeply in, to expand our imaginations as to what it means that Jesus, whom we love and trust and follow, will give you all you need, will give you his presence itself to continue living in a world that is untrustworthy. Jesus gives us love, and then he pulls us even more deeply into a center of a love that exists within love. He makes his home in God the parent, and she makes her home in us. What does it mean to be a part of this community with God, where we recognize that all are different, all are unique, but we are also one? God gives us an example of God's self in the Trinity. God models for us in the Trinity a better way of living where we are not alone. God is in constant community with God the Father, Jesus, and the Holy Spirit, distinct but inseparable. God in community with God's self and with us. If you know me, you know my faith journey is centered in the power of community. When people ask me how I've been married with joy to the same person for almost 28 years, or how I survived and many times loved being a parent, I always tell them the same thing. I could not do it without living in community. I grew up in Kenya in a culture that turns our Western understanding of individualism on its head. I learned that I am because we are. You are because we are. We are meant to live in this world with others, not just to coexist, but to interexist. My life is interwoven with yours, deeply and inextricably. Growing up in the Kenyan culture that understood that at a fundamental level, our lives unfolded differently. Our doors were always open to one another. I grew up with people streaming in and out of my house at all hours of the day and night. I learned that you were on time to an appointment when your last conversation or visit drew to a natural close. I remember my mother idling her engine in a long line of cars. We thought, what is going on up there? We peeked our heads out, and there were two people with their heads out the window having a long chat about something at the head of the line. No one honked. Everybody just waited patiently. So yes, living in community can be wildly inefficient. It slows us way down. It drives everybody nuts sometimes. Sometimes our plans for the day are ruined. Sometimes we have to share things that we'd rather use ourselves. Nobody does it perfectly, and it's messy. But our Western culture has so separated us from one another that we are bereft, suspicious of one another, fundamentally alone and lonely and in despair. We live on land marked by the sins of isolation and greed. In 1870, Western colonizers burned down the communal longhouses of the Suquamish people, so close to here. A people who understood that God's way is the way of trusting generous community where all is shared and there is enough for all. Instead, Western colonizers thought everyone would be better off apart. One family to a home with all their own possessions inside and locks on the doors. That's the way, after all, capitalism thrives. And now we know it's a way that can lead to pain and hollowness. It's a way of life that can lead to polarization, to deportations, to economic injustice and oppression. On the other hand, as people of faith, when we gaze upon the triune God, we see a different way, one where we recognize that if one person in our community is hurting, we all feel their pain. We don't just sympathize with that person, we feel it in our collective body. I was just in a seminar with the writer and theologian Rachel Chen, who researches and writes about trauma. She said something from her reading of Shelley Rambo's book, Spirit and Trauma, that electrified me. She said, when Jesus suffered and died, the entire Trinity was traumatized. God didn't turn away God's face from Jesus, and the Spirit didn't flee until the pain was over. Instead, God the parent and God the Spirit felt the devastation of the trauma of Jesus' death, and they bore it together as one. God still bears those scars And in those very scars, our community finds healing. When we live in community, we suffer and celebrate together. When you cry, we cry. When you laugh, we get to share that too. Our life together is then holy and sacred. When we live in real, sacrificial, joyful community, we learn who God is, and we become witness to the world of who God is. God with us, Spirit with us, Jesus with us. Wendell Berry is one of my favorite contemporary prophets. He's also a farmer and a writer. And he wrote some fiction and some poetry and some nonfiction. There is a quote in your bulletin that I'd like to end with. I will read it in part, but if you'd like to read the whole thing, it's there. This is from his story, Jaber Crow. What I saw now was the community imperfect and irresolute, but held together by the frayed and always fraying. There had never been anybody who had not been loved by somebody, who had not been loved by somebody else. It was a community always disappointed in itself, always disappointing its members, always trying to contain its divisions and gentle itself, its meanness, always failing and yet always persevering with a sort of will towards goodwill. The community must always be marred by members who are indifferent to it, or who are indifferent to it or against it, who are nonetheless its members and maybe nonetheless essential to it. And yet I saw them all as somehow perfected beyond time by one another's love, compassion, and forgiveness. As it is said, we may be perfected by grace. Thanks be to God.